Hello and welcome to the Racing Post, the front page, the show that takes you closer to the biggest stories in the sport. I'm your host today, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr, and I'm delighted to be joined by two of our finest journalists, James Stevens and John Harding. Welcome, guys. It's been a funny old week. It's the final day of October, and yet it feels like it could be a couple of months earlier, but at least on the track, there's no doubt what season it is. We've had, for the first time this weekend, the unrivaled dominance of the jumps, and it's thrown up lots of talking points for us to dive into. We've got a busy show ahead, so we'll dive straight in. Okay, James, we're coming to you first. What's your story this week?
Yep, so we've got a few clues, as you mentioned there on the top, about how the jump season's going to look, and I think we've sort of discussed some of the key talking points. The main one, of course, was the Charlie Hall chase at Wetherby, where Brave Man's Game, who was disappointing at the end of last season, bounced back to his very, very best and has now been cut to 5-2 for the King George second favourite, with Alaho just ahead of the market. But it was a superb performance. He jumped brilliantly. You know, this was a horse at the end of last season, was so disappointing at Aintree, ran no race at all. But in the build-up to Cheltenham, had been one of the most sort of big talking horses in Britain. We'd had a bit of time, hadn't we, after that Cheltenham, where we were searching for that next big horse that could go and break into that next level, that really elite level. And at one point, it looked like him, and he was back to his best with a brilliant display. So that was one of the key talking points from Saturday. We had a few other interesting races. One who wasn't so lucky was Goshen. I know you were there, Jonathan, on Saturday at Ascot. He was very disappointing, just didn't jump at all well, was beaten 65 lengths, which was the sort of margins he was winning by as a juvenile, believe it or not. Yeah, he just didn't look sharp enough, and Gary Moore was interesting. I listened to him after the race, sort of saying, we may give him one more try, but I think he'd conceded that, given that run, chasing wasn't going to be his game. So we can imagine seeing him back in hurdles. And, of course, yesterday, for all that we had the highs and perhaps the lows, we had the sadness British racing can sometimes be with a walkover. I suppose it's nice to see good old Pentland Hills win a race, but it would have been like to see him beat one horse. It was a walkover yesterday, highlighting that sort of ongoing issue, isn't there, of sort of field sizes. But perhaps, I think more crucially, the ground. You know, we've talked a bit about sort of the weather, the amount of rain that we haven't had, how conditions weren't safe and horses are being taken out. And it's a big problem for jump racing, because that early season sort of pattern, if it's continued to get eroded away with not many runners turning up, or the fact that horses are turning up and not running, then that's a big problem. You know, if you turned up for the first race and there wasn't any runners, that's not a good first start, is it, if you're a first-time race goer?
So we've got the full gamut of jumps racing there. But let's start with what was a highlight. Of course, Brave Man's Game versus Ahoy Senor. Yep, you're absolutely right. Brave Man's Game, fantastic performance. Got an RPR of 168 coming out of it. And is now second five for the King George. Or some bookies actually now joint favourite with Alaho. There's an unavoidable discrepancy in what they've actually achieved, though. Alaho, obviously, a dual Ryanair winner. Top RPR of 181. So on paper, you're putting a lot of faith in Brave Man's Game's ability to improve. Do you think the market's got it right?
I think the market's got it right, because we're still unsure about Alaho in terms of whether he'll turn up in the King George and what sort of Alaho will turn up, because we know he's going to be peaked for the Cheltenham Festival. We know the Ryanair is going to be his absolute number one. Will that be... Will he be really right for the day? Will it sort of be on the way up to Ryanair in terms of fitness? Whereas we know Paul Nicholls, he doesn't mince his words, does he? He has said, this is his aim. I'm going to get him right for there. He's already won over the course and distance. Sort of, you know that the very, very best Brave Man's Game will be at Kempton. Whereas we can't be sure if Alaho will turn up for one, and two, whether that'll be a peak Alaho. If it's a peak Alaho, then yes, as you say, he's going to walk all over. But that's where the market is, and it's fascinating to see what's going to happen.
And Paul Nicholls, of course, loves talking up his horses, not because he exaggerates them, but I think he's just full of enthusiasm for the next star to come through. Brave Man's Game obviously had some lofty comparisons, and Paul Nicholls has such an association with the King George that perhaps people are factoring that in as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and we know he loves the race. You know, I think he's been pretty honest with the way he sort of campaigned his horses. He's said that, well, it's not all about Cheltenham, because I've got a horse here, and a bit like Clandestobo, of course, one that perhaps people have sort of forgotten about in this sort of grand scheme of good horses he's had recently. His horse has been campaigned away from Cheltenham. He tried him in the Gold Cup. It didn't work, so he said, well, look, I'm not going to try. Paul Nicholls, the way he's campaigned them is a bit more cleverly. He's not been sort of sucked into the sort of Cheltenham is the absolute thing and everything's about Cheltenham. And I think people are aware of that. And so you know that he is target training races outside of Cheltenham, which not many trainers seem to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Ahoy Senor, though, what do we think? You know, have you lost faith, or is this just an early season blip that can be readily forgiven?
I think I'm leaning towards the benefit of the doubt here. I think it probably was an early season blip. Lucinda Russell, discussing the performance, said he was like a kid on his first day of school, raced far too keenly, and when you've got quite an exuberant jumper anyway in Ahoy Senor going too quickly over his fences, you can see what happened, and you can see why he ran out of petrol, essentially. Mm. I wouldn't be writing him off at all. I think he'll probably go and be very competitive in the Many Clouds next. But they need to sort his jumping out, of course. They've worked on it, clearly, and there's time. He clearly has a great deal of talent, but it's just putting it all together now. But I think he's one that probably needed the run, and I wouldn't discount him completely at all.
We had in the paper today David Carr pointing out that Sylvain Jacques-Conti and Kew Card both flopped in the Charlie Hall in the last 10 years and then went on to win the Betfair Chase on their next start. So certainly a precedent that early season flops can often be very misleading. But let's turn to Ascot. You were there to see the mercurial, enigmatic Goshen make his eagerly anticipated chasing debut. Didn't go to script.
No, it was a bit... It was a bit disappointing, really, because we'd all built him up to be, when quite rightly, given what he could do when he was at his best. We saw him in the Elite Hurdle and at Sandown. He was just absolutely electric, had all the makings of, if he can translate this over fences, he's going to be a real novice chaser to follow. But it just, from the get-go, it didn't happen for him. Just didn't seem to get on with it at all. Jumping was a little bit suspect, and you just saw him fall back and back and back through the field, and it was just, really disappointing. And it's a peculiar one, because Gary Moore said in the build-up, I spoke to him before the race for our preview, and he said he doesn't look like a chaser. I don't think he was fully convinced it was a case of we're getting him out to try it. His half-sister is a chaser. Ellie May, I believe, won the Mayor's Chase at the festival. So there's a bit of form there. There's something to suggest he would have taken to it. But it was quite dejected, Gary Moore, after the race, because I think everyone had high hopes for him, because at his best he is an exceptional racehorse. But I think he's a hurdler. And I think he said he might give him another try of offences if the ground is soft. I'm not sure that he will. I think he'll probably draw stumps on chasing for this season at least.
James, what would you do? One more try?
Yeah, definitely has to have one more try. And I think anyone who sort of thinks that going back hurdling is going to be easy needs to remember that Constitution Hill and Honeysuckle are about. So it's not going to be easy wherever he goes. Worth one more try, but to be honest with you, I'd be very surprised if he continues over fences.
Yeah. Let's finish our run through the jumps action with Huntingdon. And of course, that walkover for Pentland Hills. I think there were just 26 runners on the card. It was on ground, which was officially given as good. Some trainers and jockeys thought it was firmer than that. Others thought it was safe, fine ground. You know, I guess the big question here is this an example of how British jumps racing is facing some massive structural problems, or is this just a case of the ground being unseasonably unsuitable for jumps races at a point of year when we'd normally expect it to be much softer?
I think climate's definitely a massive part of it, because I don't think that people will talk about how sort of we've not had the rain throughout the spring and the summer, and so it has impacted the whole sort of the racing surface. But this is climate. This is what is happening in the world nowadays. So I think it's about watching this, maybe not straight away thinking, okay, the problem. It's just watching over 2, 3, 4 years and just seeing what conditions are tending to be like and adjusting that programme accordingly. We've talked in here about fixture lists, about patterns, and it seems to go around in circles. But the climate is a massive part of that we're going to have to factor in. Are we going to be able to have races like the Persian War this early in the season? Will we have to push them back? Is that something that's going to have to change? It's going to take time to understand the climate, understand the rainfall, and see how the whole world is evolving. But regarding Huntingdon, I think the other sort of key element to that is the last meeting. I think it was the last meeting they had there. There's a couple of horses that slipped and they abandoned after two races. So perhaps trainers were a little bit more wary than they normally would be.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. But, you know, it's been a tough year for jumps trainers, because not only are they trying to sort of get runs into the horses. They are just trying to be wary of those conditions. So it's going to be interesting to see, I think, how fitness levels compare with Ireland and such, and those sort of early clashes, because I think we are, certainly in the west of England, where I seem to be, where I'm sort of centred around, the ground is very, very quick. You know, Exeter and Wincanton are going to struggle to get entries in their big weekends just because of the ground. So I think this is going to be a situation that is going to continue evolving years to come.
Yeah, we obviously heard the UN report last week saying there's no route for the world to keep global warming to the target of 1.5 centigrade. So we're going to see a lot more weather change in the coming decades, with, frankly, very unpredictable impacts on sports like racing, which are so contingent on the ground. I mean, I read in Lee Morrishead's preview from Melbourne in today, it's going to be warmer in Redcar than in Flemington tomorrow, which is an extraordinary state of affairs. They've had the opposite issue to us in Australia. They've had very heavy rain through the spring, particularly in Sydney, but also recently in Melbourne. What does this say about the future of racing, John? I mean, how is the sport going to adjust, or is it just a complete imponderable?
I think it's almost one of those. I mean, the whole issue generally is almost so large that it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around, and it is just going to be, as in daily life, going to have to be an adaptation by the sport. But you can see the knock-on effects, and we've got Nicky Henderson talking in tomorrow's newspaper saying he just simply hasn't felt comfortable getting so many of his horses out because the ground's too quick. And we're only going to have more instances of this going forward, but what interests me is this contention over the word good in a going description, because I spoke to Chris Gordon before. Of course, he's the trainer who pulled out his horse who was going to take on Pentland Hills, and he said, we're after genuinely good ground. And he's got there and said he was frightened by how quick it was. I spoke to the clerk of the course, who said we're having to water to maintain, and there's a reluctance for trainers to run horses on watered ground. So that seems to be the point of debate here, is about a slight mistrust of clerks of the course. And then you've got clerks of the course essentially fighting an impossible battle against the climate. And that battle is only going to get harder and harder and harder.
Yeah, I think we're all going to become experts on soil saturation and weather patterns over the coming decades, I'm afraid. OK, we will move on to the second story, and this one's from me. I'm going to follow up about Willie Mullins' very interesting comments from earlier last week when he was speaking to our colleague Mark Boylan about the launch of the jump season. And one of the topics he talked about, which got picked up on and prompted a lot of debate, was the question of what gaps between races should be. Basically, Willie Mullins' contention was that 35-minute gaps between races are too long. They make the day long and unappealing. And he said there's only so many cups of tea you can have between races. And he says he wants to be maximum 30-minute gaps and a buzz return to the track. Now, the context of all of this is really important, because it comes across a backdrop of falling attendances in Ireland and Britain. First 6 months of the year in Ireland, they were down 9% versus 2019. And January to August in Britain, they were down 17% against 2019. So we're seeing some really sharp falls in attendances. We don't quite know exactly to what degree the cost of living crisis is a factor in that, to what degree people just not coming back after COVID is a factor, and to what degree people not wanting to go racing as much is a factor, but I think we can reasonably assume they are all parts of it. So clearly thinking about how can we make the racing experience as interesting and engaging as possible is part of it. And there's a few different strands to that, but let's start with Willie's comments, James. What's the optimum gap between races?
I would say 35 to 40. I think.
So you think a longer gap, yeah?
Yeah. So I was a punter yesterday at Carlisle for the Colin Parker Day. So I thought I'm going to trial it out, and actually it was a mix. Sometimes they were like 33, sometimes they're 35. You didn't notice. And yesterday was really, really good day. The weather was awful, but that's jump racing. And the time it takes to sort of get a drink, have a look at them in the paddock, you know, if you're with a group, which I was, you know, you're sort of waiting for other people and stuff. I think that's fine. I have a different opinion to Willie Mullins, because I think that those gaps isn't the main issue, personally. I think that it's how you fill them, you know. There are some people that will want to go to the paddock. There are some people who want to get a drink. But then I went to Galway in the summer, and I was amazed by the experience there, because there was music on in some areas and it was really lively. It was like a party, a bit like you discussed last week with the best mate at Cheltenham with the 5,000 students, and some people were all about that experience. And then there's other parts of the track were a bit quieter, and you could sort of have a sort of look at the horses, and it was quite quiet and it was quite settled. So I think breaking up that race course and allowing the different zones is how to entertain people rather than the minutes gaps themselves.
Yeah, it's all about giving people what they want. And clearly, you get different tribes on a race course, don't you? You've got Willie Mullins, who's there basically to see his horses run. And if you could have the races back to back with no gap between them at all, and then he could leave, I'm sure he would not be averse to doing that. But if you're there with friends and you're having a social experience, then 30 minutes between races is quite tight. If you're there on your own, 30 minutes can seem like a lifetime, and the lack of other entertainment, if it's not there, is a factor. So I think what they need to do is think about, well, how do we provide different things to different people in different parts of the race course? You know, one of the things I always think we miss at race courses is interviews. Now some tracks do this, but others don't, and it means that you can be watching a really interesting race with perhaps a massive talking point, and yet if you're at the track, you have no idea, you know, what connection's made of it or what the upshot of it is. You know, what would you like to see change, John, for the race day experience?
Well, I mean, for starters, as much as I don't like to disagree with Willie Mullins, I think he's got this wrong, certainly on the big days. I think you need that gap, and, you know, slightly I'll declare some vested interests here. We all have, as journalists, we want that time to get in, talk to connections, and once you've fought past TV crews and on-course people and the horses away and all the rest of it, it can be quite difficult to fit that in before the next races. Often we talk about trying to promote our biggest races and our biggest days generally. Well, you know, coverage, quotes from connections, breakout stories is all part of that, and there needs to be a time for us to do our job and try and shine a light on these things.
Yeah.
Slightly vested interests, I know.
Slightly, yeah.
But I think it's a fair point. I think it is actually important that you want time for the TV crews to talk to owners, talk to jockeys, get properly dissect the race before we move on to the next one. If it was a case of horse comes in, owner, trainer has a quick word with the jockey and owner and then disappears to saddle the next runner, I think we'd lose a lot of colour from the day. So I think, yeah, just on the timings, that would be it. As for the actual experience, it's the similar things that we've gone over before, isn't it? You know, I think the amount of time is correct. It's how we fill that time, as you quite rightly say. And again, it's restaurant offerings. It's not having to take out a small loan to buy a pint. It's all of these things that we've discussed, you know, those extra efforts, nice little touches of music. And can we, like you say, the interviews. But I was at Ascot on Saturday, and there were people hanging around the winner's enclosure to listen to the connections get interviewed by the people on course. People are genuinely interested. It's not all about gimmicks and how we can kind of shepherd people through to place their next bet. That some people are very interested in hearing about the horses afterwards, and good on them.
James, if you were able to make one change to the race day experience, what would it be?
What would I change? I think I would probably look at, as I said, the idea of zones and creating more sort of understanding the day first and foremost. I mean, yes, there at Carlisle is a Sunday, it's a bit wet, it's a bit miserable. That chilled atmosphere is fine, but on those big race days, I think we need to be having areas which can embrace sort of young people, students, whatever, with a bit of live music. So I think my one change would be that race courses and race meetings are marketed certain ways. So for example, there are so many different theme nights at Windsor, and I always wonder why other tracks don't do it. You know, you've got a normal Thursday night or a Friday night at Sandown or I don't know, Newbury or something, and sometimes they have theme night, but really push it through. So like really good food, you know, really good food offerings. Like they had Caribbean night, and the food's wonderful, and it's local people and they're passionate about it, and you can tell that, and you try it, oh, it's great. And then proper good music and stuff, and just really sell the day as not just a day at the races, but this is a day at the races with something different, because I think that will break through. And people who thought, well, I've been racing before, okay, well, this is an 80s night, or this is something, oh, that sounds really cool, that sounds really exciting, you know, and try and cater it and really market a day at the races as not just horses going to run, you're going to place a bet. Really try and offer something different, because as we've talked about on the show, there is so much pressure on people's disposable income at the minute. You're going to have to really knock on their door and get them out rather than wait for them to come to you.
It's a super competitive environment. We know right now people are making cutbacks, understandably. One of the obvious ones to me is cashless race courses. Mm-hmm. Now, this made plenty of sense in the aftermath of COVID, when contactless payments had taken a big leap forward, and race courses were understandably keen to move forward into that. They save money, and it's logistically much less challenging not to have to put in place floats for cash all over a track. But it's probably the most common topic in our Racing Post mailbag from racegoers that they absolutely loathe this, because they're going racing and they're finding that even if they can get through the door, they can't get a drink, they can't get a cup of coffee. You know, it just seems mind-blowing to me that when you've got an audience, particularly on weekdays, which does trend older, you would not put in place the facilities that enables them to pay by their chosen method.
Yeah, I think it's madness, and I think Ascot has got it right, as it gets a lot of these things right, but it offers the ability to do both. I mean, like, I'm from the generation, I suppose we are as well, I just wouldn't carry cash, really. So it doesn't bother, I would assume that I'd be paying for everything on card, but I'd still take cash to bet with on the rails. But it's important to recognise that actually there is a generation of people who would be the polar opposite of that and wouldn't use their card and would be relying on the fact that they take a certain amount of cash for the day. That's what they're willing to spend on the day. It is a lot easier to track your payments with cash as well, which is quite important, and I'll get on to that. But I think it's about catering for everybody. What I think race courses get wrong, perhaps, I don't think they'll advertise themselves as being cashless. And what they almost need to do is caveat that in fairly big red letters and say, but you can bet with cash on course with the on-course bookmakers, because I know a complaint from their side is, while they're moving with the times and they have card readers, that slows it down. And for them, it's not so much the amount, it's not so much the quantity of the bets placed, or in terms of the amount that's placed on a bet, it's the number that they can get through for a fairly short space of time. So them having to take a card payment actually loses them a fair bit of business, and they want to encourage cash as much as possible. And I think from a safer gambling point of view as well, I think it's probably better that people are betting with cash than card, anecdotally.
Well, it's a key part of the race course experience, isn't it? You know, putting your money on in cash with a bookmaker, and then if you hit the target, getting a payout, you know, and particularly if you land a decent little coup and you think, right, off to the bar and the champagne's on me. But then if you can't pay for the champagne in the cash and you have to put it on your credit card or something, it slightly diminishes the sort of glory of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think the other key thing here as well, and what you've sort of picked up on there, Jonathan, is that we need to be supporting the on-course bookmakers. And there's not many ways we can sort of support them without sort of trying to make the situation easier. So encouraging people to take cash and then using the on-course bookmakers, because everyone knows now how easy it is to bet on your phone, and it's so common. And I think one of the discussions I've sort of had with people my sort of age is how often they go down the front and they don't carry cash. So why would they? You know, they've got their accounts.
Even at the races?
Even at the races.
Not even
at
a bet?
No. They're all on the phone. On the phone. And if we're actively encouraging people not to take cash because it's a cashless race course, then those bookies aren't going to be keep turning up, because they're not going to be making any money, especially on those days where there is a bigger, younger crowd. So I think in the interest of keeping them, keeping the money they generate for the race course, the experience that it gives, we want to see them. They are part of the game, and if we don't support them, it's not going to be the same. And we're all going to sit here and say, oh, what could we have done? This is exactly what we could have done. You know, it makes no sense. I cannot understand really why they don't have cash at the race course. It's what people want. It doesn't really affect them massively. It's something they can get round. I think it's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. A topic I'm certain we'll return to again in due course, and indeed the on-course bookmakers, another fascinating angle. We'll wrap up the discussion there, because we want to get on to, John, your story, which is you're going to look at Mick Shannon's retirement.
Yeah, so this is the story that the charismatic trainer Mick Shannon is going to retire at the end of the season, at the age of 73, after 33 years as a trainer and a fabulous career he's had. And important to know, his second career, not only has he been an international footballer, which, we all wanted to be, didn't we, growing up. He's also been a very successful Group 1 winning, classic winning trainer. Most famous horse of his was Youm Zayn, of course. He finished second in the Arc, more times than he'll probably care to remember, but a fabulous horse, more than 2,500 winners on the flat, and just opened the discussion up about a fantastic career that he's had. He's going to be handing the reins over, pun very much intended, to his son, Jack, who recently finished his modules. It's been a long time coming. There's been a sort of succession plan. Jack's been abroad learning his trade, which is going to prove very important for him. Logical end to his career, passing it on to his son. But what interests me most about this story is challenging time, I think, for a young trainer. We've seen with the likes of George Scott and James Ferguson, who obviously has Deauville Legend running in the Melbourne Cup. We've seen a different approach, a different business model that's required. So in the old days, when Mick Shannon started training, let's say, it was more a case of you kind of fed off your domestic winnings, really. You had perhaps a few big owners in the yard that kept you afloat. But now, with the prize money as it is in Britain, it's going to be a lot harder for these young guys and girls. And they're looking now at campaigning their horses a lot more internationally, because the returns make British returns look embarrassing, to be honest. And they're also going to have to sell a lot of their horses abroad when they get a good one. Quite understandably, an owner's going to see a bit of money coming in from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and that's going to be a key source of income for them as well. So it's interesting. I know that Jack will be aware of all of this, and he's not the only trainer who's in this environment, but it's just an interesting kind of ending of one chapter and beginning of another.
Yeah, I mean, on the surface, you'd have to say, notwithstanding the fact that having a family connection in racing and the facilities to inherit, horses to inherit, is a massive leg up, it's not an ideal time to be starting out in the trade. We obviously know the issues around prize money, but you've also got the cost of living crisis, and you've got a staffing crisis. What does the picture look like right now for young trainers, James?
I think it's a massive struggle. I think if we sort of focus on the flat, I think that amount of interest overseas at the minute for British horses, and that sort of idea of British horses running to a good level and being sold abroad, that is really quite interesting, because as a trainer, you're going to be keeping that in the back of your mind, that actually, you know, if you've got an owner in there and you think, well, this could be a horse that could potentially go and run in Australia, or it could go and run in sort of one of the sort of countries in the Middle East, you're going to be wary and campaign them accordingly, because what you want is you want to get the best for your owner. You know, if you are, you don't want to fool an owner by saying, yeah, let's stay in Britain and win £4,000 for a handicap on a Thursday afternoon. You want to say, look, this horse might be worth quite a bit of money, so, and then make sure they come back. So that's an interesting sort of concept that you sort of touch on there. And I think that because of the prize money problems we have, British racing is a real hard sell. And I think that anyone who may have quite a lot of money will be looking at, well, why would I go with a trainer here when I could go abroad and the money's a lot better? We see that quite a bit with France as well. I think that's sort of a country we haven't sort of really touched on, but especially in Britain, there's quite a lot of sort of satellite yards and things. I think with a trainer like Jack, I mean, what one of the things Mick was brilliant at was buying horses cheaply and getting the best. Yim Zane cost 30,000 guineas. It's just madness. I mean, I know it's a few years ago and prices have gone up, but being able to find those cheaper horses, those gems, I suppose, I think it's getting really, really tough. Mm. You know, you think about the horses in Cheltenham that have been, Brave Man's Game was 370, Envoy LN, I know, wasn't quite what, you know, he was a sales topper. We're seeing the sort of the good horses that are taking a trainer like Mick Shannon, who hasn't got the same sort of high quality bred horses as a Charlie Appleby or Aidan O'Brien. Competing with them is becoming more and more challenging because of buying power and the fact that things are more expensive. So attracting an owner and saying we may have a Derby horse is a lot harder now than it possibly would have been when Mick was 10, 15 years ago.
It's quite a vicious circle as well, because when you do get a good horse, the offers invariably come in, and those offers are only going to become harder to refuse when your costs are going up, when prize money is showing no signs of improving. And it's people get quite excited about the export of horses abroad. It has been happening for a while. It's not a new phenomenon. British racing has been an export jurisdiction as much as it's been a kind of import and a producer of talent. But it's the types of horses that are going out now, with the, particularly the Middle East, with them coordinating and joining the dots on their program. And Bahrain's got kind of its handicap series. Saudi Arabia's putting on, frankly, ludicrous money. Qatar, the same. the dots are being joined. There's now a full campaign out there for horses, and it's no longer the very best horses who maybe get picked up to run or a specific type that might run well in Australia. It's just any horse 90 rated or above is at risk of being sold abroad.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating last week at the horses and training sale in Newmarket, the number of Saudi buyers. Mm. And they're all buying to take the horses to Saudi. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's been one of the massive changes over the last couple of decades, where once these fabulously wealthy Middle Eastern owners would tend to buy horses to set up strings in one of the big three European jurisdictions. Now, they have this increasingly well-developed domestic program, you know, and by domestic I mean across the Middle East, because they are trying to join it up, which means that they don't need to set things up here. Now, I think this is having two really interesting knock-on effects. The first is that you've got, for these young, hungry trainers, you know, the need to develop a different business model. And they've actually done this fabulously well because, you know, faced with an increasingly uncompetitive domestic scene and the realisation that they would not be able to compete at the level they want to or grow their business to the degree they want to by purely focusing on the traditional British racing, they've worked out, okay, we can combine targeting international races with targeting international owners and with selling horses. And they're actually developing, you know, really good businesses. And like with any sport, you know, things evolve. I guess where the concern is, and this one is certainly widely hailed within racing, it's this idea that racing, British racing, becomes a sort of a pre-training environment. And if we do that, we then potentially lose the quality of bloodstock which creates the source material which underlines the strength of the sort of British racing's appeal for international buyers. So potentially this is, you know, this is either an evolution of the training model or it's the sort of inexorable decline as we flog off the family silver, basically. Which one do you think, James?
I would say that at this point in time, it seems more like the latter. But I think that we're becoming more and more aware of what's going on. And Ireland's very different than Britain, I think. You know, the breeding powers over there is, you know, that's sort of a way it's sort of modelled almost. You know, so many great Irish horses get bred and sold abroad, especially in the jumps and stuff. So a little bit wary. I think that what will sort of happen is, I think that where horses are beginning to be sold and stuff, the market always changes. The market always changes, and it might be that we are seeing quite a lot of good horses sell. But actually, over here, there's going to be sort of more interest in breeding and, you know, OK, maybe we're not going to sell our yearlings. You know, maybe we're going to race them, you know, if it's so weak here. You know, we're going to keep on and see what we can do with them, you know. So maybe that will change. But at the moment, it certainly seems to go in that way, and it's a huge concern because, you know, the real appeal that British racing has, that with all due respect, most other jurisdictions would love to have, is that tradition. It's that sort of the Epsom Derby, Royal Ascot. They are like the events you want to be at, the events the events across the world people recognise, and they think, oh, they are the real big horse racing races. Most of them are in Britain. You know, there's a few all over the world, the Melbourne Cup tomorrow, Mid Breeders' Cup, you know, races like that. But we have that real tradition, and to be able to win here, the appeal of that, we have to just make sure it's there, because if we're losing the talent and people are saying, oh, the Derby's really weak this year, there's nothing really good in there, then suddenly the whole product as a sport is under huge, huge fear. It's under threat, you know?
Yeah. Well put, and good luck to Jack. A tricky time to start out, but I'm sure with his old man's advice, he will be doing pretty well. So it remains for me to determine what is the biggest story of the week, the one that goes on the coveted front page, and it's got to be jumps racing, doesn't it? It simply is the story we're all focusing on. Great to see these proper horses coming out again. And, you know, even Goshen flopping is a reminder of the sheer unpredictability of the jump season. Every year it happens, bubbles get burst. It's what makes it so fascinating. So the jump season is on the front page. And so it remains for me to say thank you so much for joining us. Please do have a look in the description, where you'll find a link to take advantage of our latest Members Club Ultimate offer. And also, if you haven't already downloaded our new app, please do so. There's a range of app-exclusive content on there, the latest of which is the Paul Nicholls Stable Tour. So do download it and check that out and let us know what you think. Thanks a million for joining us, and we'll see you next week.